With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Insurance and drone bills top new laws of interest to farmers. More after the break. A number of new state laws are set to impact California farmers in the coming months after Governor Gavin Newsom ended the legislative year by signing a flurry of bills. Assembly Bill 1016 authorizes California's Department of Pesticide Regulation to modernize the certification process for farmers to use drones to spray pesticides and beneficial biological treatments on farms. Senate Bill 505 was created to improve commercial property insurance options for people who have struggled to access coverage due to the impacts of wildfires. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines with another recently signed law. Implementing Senate Bill 553 in Ag Operations. Implementing workplace violence prevention plans may look differently for ag operations than it would for a business with a conventional workspace such as an office. AgSafe President and CEO Teresa Keene shares more.
I also think that, implementing this in the agricultural space might look a little different than in our traditional office setting. And so as ag employers, we're going to have to think about how to implement this and just the different procedures that we're going to have to put in place, when you're at a work site that is remote. So what does that look like? How do you train your employees if an incident should happen, and how to get them ready? If law enforcement comes in and there was an incident, there are lots of things for our ag employers to consider. And AgSafe will be working hard on this issue to help, put together maybe some best practices, talk to other employers that are already doing this, because I know that many have, and kind of pull together the best pieces and help small and larger organizations and operations figure this out.
And this legislation was created simultaneously with new standards by CalOSHA. And while CalOSHA has yet to release the specifics of its standard, Keene says the new law has a few record-keeping and training requirements.
What we have in SB 553 is that we also know that employers need to keep the records of if there was an incident or a write-up or all the training that needs to take place, so like active shooter training. They're going to need to keep that on hand for 5 years. So we're going to know a lot more in the coming weeks, hopefully months, so we can start to everybody get together and figure out what this looks like.
And now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
The new clean truck check rule established by the California Air Resources Board has some upcoming deadlines. Director of Regulatory and Environmental Affairs for Western United Dairies, Paul Souza, said farmers and ranchers have gotten a bit of a break from what the rule initially had proposed, and there are some requirements that will need to be met by the end of the year.
We did get kind of an exemption for trucks used in agriculture. They only have to be done once per year, so, more than our cars, which are every other year. But other trucks, if you're not in agriculture, will be up to 4 times per year. And it doesn't matter what fuel, diesel, compressed natural gas, propane, gasoline, this is going to apply to all trucks over 14,000 pounds gross vehicle weight rating. As part of this, it's another big difference from the smog check program for cars is that you must register your truck in an ARB database for the clean truck check program. And I've been on the ARB website. They have a fact sheet that states, and I quote, required information must be entered for vehicles in their fleet that are subject to the clean truck check and the $30 per vehicle compliance fee paid for all vehicles in the fleet by December 31st. And so we've got a new deadline coming up. Folks have got to get their truck registered in this database and pay a $30 fee per vehicle. I'm trying to, get outreach out there so that folks are aware of this. I think a lot of folks are not aware of this.
Agricultural businesses are looking at a variety of new rules and requirements. President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, highlighted some of the issues that ag businesses are going to need to keep in mind.
I think the things that growers and, any kind of ag processing need to look at, number one, the governor signed the paid sick leave bill, so it's going to go from 3 days to 5 days. We know that's going to have an impact. Workplace violence standard. We knew CalOSHA was working on one, but now the legislature has passed a bill mandating it and the governor signed it. There will be a new workplace violence standard that we're all going to have to write plans for and do training, whether you've had issues there or not. That's going to be a new standard. We know Cal OSHA is on the verge of adopting the indoor heat illness standard. Going to be something else that growers and hullers and anybody with any kind of farm shop or gin or huller are going to have to address. So there's a lot coming beyond what we've already talked about. Things are going to get tougher before they get better.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota questioned Susan Bodine, partner at Earth and Water Law, on the implications of the Sackett versus the Environmental Protection Agency decision on the Waters of the United States, or WOTUS, determinations under the Clean Water Act, which directly impacts landowners across the United States. Ms. Bodine is the former assistant administrator for the EPA's Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance under the Trump administration, where she was responsible for enforcing environmental statutes under the EPA's jurisdiction. Here is a portion of his questioning.
For those of us that want to go back and forward seven generations, my sixth great-grandfather gave his life at Bunker Hill for the cause of liberty. And I believe if we're going to use broad definitions, that would be for the cause of federalism. Not an insignificant issue that we should ignore for the science. But I want to ask you, Ms. Bodine, because earlier this year in this committee, Lieutenant General Spellman, the head of the Corps of Engineers, testified. I gasped when he said it. He said it rather casually in the context of workforce. He said that the Corps of Engineers considers about 80 federal issues a year, decisions, 80,000 federal decisions per year. Do you believe that if there's 80,000 regulatory actions by the Corps of Engineers, that the clarification, the simplification of Sackett should reduce that workload for the Corps of Engineers, and perhaps there's some efficiency that we could actually gain from this?
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see that, because the way they set it up, it is going to be case-by-case determinations instead of bright definitions.
Thank you. And that's my concern. It's like, how much simpler could they make it? And, you know, how much more prescriptive could they have been? And I suppose you could say we could be more prescriptive if we change the Clean Water Act to the Navigable Waters Act. But we don't call the Endangered Species Act the Every Species Act. Titles are one thing, definitions another thing. I want to ask you about permitting reform. Senator Capito referenced the importance of it. A lot of us on all sides of the issue are concerned about and want some permitting reform. And one of the things that I've emphasized throughout this debate is it's become just as difficult to permit a wind farm or a solar farm, panel farm or a transmission line as it is a fuels pipeline of some sort. And transmission lines and pipelines, and for that matter, interstate highways, are long linear, right? Long linear, it's often, almost always, multi-state, multi-jurisdictional infrastructure. And because of the complexity of this type of infrastructure, Congress established the nationwide permit program to allow these projects to obtain one permit as long as they're determined to have a minimal effect on the environment. Can you discuss the importance of a nationwide permit and maybe also considering both the efficiency of it as well as the effectiveness, I guess, of a nationwide permit?
Yeah, the Corps of Engineers nationwide permits is really the reason why we haven't completely stopped building infrastructure in this country, because it is a more efficient and truncated review based on minimal impacts. There has been a gradual narrowing of the nationwide permits, which means that more and more would be subject to the individual permits, which are what take years and years and years and subject of lawsuits. If there isn't federal jurisdiction, then you don't need to get the nationwide permit. But that question is going to be decided case by case, and it remains to be seen how that'll.
Earlier this year, Lieutenant General Spellman from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers stated that the Corps performs approximately 80,000 regulatory actions every year. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the USDA released their October cattle on feed report, and it shows the number of cattle and calves on feed for the slaughter market in the U.S. for feedlots with a capacity of 1,000 head or more was at 11.6 million head on October 1st. That's 1% above October 1 of last year. And according to a story from Gary Crawford, the report surprised some in the trade.
Nature is obviously continuing to play a very heavy impact on producer decisions.
USDA livestock analyst Chael Shagham's comments after studying Friday's surprising cattle on feed report showing more cattle than expected being placed into feedlots during September, fewer marketings of fed cattle, winding up with a surprisingly large feedlot inventory October 1st, 11.6 million head. That would be 1% more than a year ago.
And would be the second highest October 1st inventory number since the series began in 1996.
As to his comment about the impact of nature, Shagham says large areas of the nation are still in drought, forage supplies very short, also some serious worry about
availability of water in parts of the country in terms of, you know, stock tanks and ponds are in parts of the country also very, very low.
Prices for feeders very, very high, so off they go to feedlots. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And USDA livestock analyst Chael Shagham says cattle producers are still sending more heifers to feedlots instead of holding them for breeding.
It gives us a snapshot on October 1st of the breakouts of cattle on feed by sex. And heifer and heifer calves were about 1% above a year ago. And if we look at them as a proportion of the total number of animals on feed on October 1st, they were 40%. Compared to about 39.8% a year ago. We are probably, again, digging fairly deep into that pool of animals outside feedlots. And the fact that we are still looking at very high proportion of heifers on feed would indicate that, you know, quite a bit of those animals are female stock that went into the feedlots.
Now, the inventory at 11.6 million head included 6.95 million steers and steer calves, up slightly from the previous year. This group accounted for 60% of the total inventory. Heifers and heifer calves accounted for 4.64 million head. That's up 1% from last year. Now, placements and feedlots during September at 2.21 million head was 6% above last year, while marketings of fed cattle during September at 1.66 million head was 11% below last year. In other news, a quick note, milk production in the 24 major dairy states in September at 17.5 billion pounds was up slightly from September of last year. And the four largest meat packers were hit by a new price-fixing lawsuit from a group of small food distributors. The suit was filed October 9th in the U.S. District Court in Northern Illinois, accusing the packers of fixing prices for years. The plaintiffs said the price-fixing dates back to at least January 1 of 2015. This includes Cargill, JBS, Tyson Foods, and National Beef Packing Company. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
October is Rural Cooperative Month, but what are rural cooperatives? That's coming up on This Land of Ours. October is Rural Cooperative Month, and a part of USDA's rural development focuses on business cooperatives and their vital role in rural economies. Rural Business Cooperative Service Administrator Crema Neal provides various examples of rural business cooperatives and how they serve customers both locally and nationally.
You'll see food cooperatives where folks will band together to market different foods. That can be a cooperative. Cooperative farming happens frequently. Financial services, credit unions, which are cooperative. Rural electric cooperatives. Rural electric cooperatives are another tool that are really important in rural communities where folks may have interest there. More than half the nation's land mass is served by rural electric cooperatives. That's That's 42 million people, including 92% of persistent poverty communities are served by rural electric cooperatives. So really, we see cooperatives in all sectors of the economy, and people encounter them every day, whether they know it or not.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. You might be a younger person that is eager to start farming, but are you ready? It's a big undertaking with every decision impacting the bottom line and the future of a farm that may have been in the family for generations. So what should you consider before you transition into a position of ownership and control of the farming operation? What should the younger generation wanting to farm keep in mind? Make sure you listen to your elders and glean from their wealth of information and experience. Another one is to gain practical experience in planting and harvesting, maintaining equipment, financial management, taxes, legal issues, and marketing. Also, make sure to develop a business plan that outlines your short and long-term goals, as well as your financial projections, marketing strategies, and risk management. Make sure to attend meetings on farming practices, as well as the business and legal aspects of the farming operation. Networking is also important. Make connections with fellow farmers, ag experts, and industry professionals. Stay up on market trends and consumer preferences, and look for additional revenue streams. Don't hesitate to get professional advice. A good farm accountant and lawyer can be invaluable. And always be patient and work hard. A family farming legacy wasn't built in a single growing season, and continuing it is a process, one that can be very rewarding. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
A look at this year's major U.S. tree nut crops by production and prices can be summed up this way by USDA economic researcher Seth Wechsler.
I think the story for 2023 is that nut production's up, but the prices received by domestic nut growers are way, way down.
First, a look at almond production for 2023.
We see about a 1.5% increase in production. This is going to be just about the third largest production on record at 2.6 billion pounds or so. The main factor driving increases in aggregate production are increases in bearing acreage. There was some stormy and temperate weather this spring and some variable growing conditions which depressed yields.
Those yields, the lowest observed since 2006.
But these adverse weather conditions or unfavorable weather conditions weren't sufficiently adverse to offset gains associated with having more land in production.
Coupled with high ending stocks, and almond prices are expected to remain low. As for walnuts,
walnut acreage actually decreased for the first time since about the turn of the century, 2023. That's because walnut prices are really historically low.
Yet walnut production is record-tying, matching 2020's all-time high crop. Wechsler adds objective yield results were not available for hazelnuts, but based on historical trends and industry sources,
it is our sense that this year's crop should be a big one.
In fact, record-breaking, according to preliminary reports, perhaps even greater than the 85,000 tons that industry insiders were anticipating. That number could tie last year's record hazelnut crop. The expected record production in the U.S., coupled with inflationary pressure within another major global hazelnut-producing country, Turkey, is expected to place downward pressure on prices for this marketing year. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
December corn's short stay above $5 did allow for a strong base to set up, while December cattle now searching for any kind of a base. I'm Mark Oppold with today's Bottom Line Report, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Discover the entire lineup of combines, forage harvesters, tractors, balers, and more at Kloss.com. December corn hit a wall last week at the 100-day moving average, 509, but in the process building a strong base, 488 to 490. In soybeans, fund traders are holding net short positions there, first time that's happened since April 2020. January soybeans are in for a battle to hold $13. Wheat trade looks stuck sideways for another week or so, and in cotton only wishes it could find a range, now the lowest since early in July. This is the Bottom Line Report. Well, it will take more than a day for live cattle to regroup after the negative cattle on feed report last Friday. December's next support, in our view, is down at the 178.80 level. Looks like the market will test that level. Superior Livestock recent auction showed buyers are very cautious. 28,000 head from 23 states were provided, and lighter weight steers and heifers steady to $4 lower. Heavier weights were down $7 to $12. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Dave Brennan, planter marketing manager for Case IH, talks about why Case IH added the smaller early riser planters to their portfolio.
We've had a premium technology offering in our planters since the launch of the 2000 series early riser planter back in 2016, but those typically have only been larger sized planters, I'll say 12 row and above. When you get down to it, technology can benefit all of those growers, and specifically those growers that maybe are a little smaller than average field size and are mixed revenue operators. That technology really helps them not only with productivity, but agronomically speaking as well, and it improves their bottom line opportunity.
He talks about which farmers need a planter of this size.
Those mixed revenue operators really can benefit from an increased level of productivity. Those growers are typically feeding livestock in the morning, switching gears, going to more of their row crop scenario midday, and then back to feeding their livestock in the evening. So those growers really can benefit from that increased level of productivity to get as much done as they can in those narrow operating windows. In addition to that, the early riser 2120 can be a game changer for any grower looking at a 6-row, 8-row, 30-inch configuration, or even our 11-row, 15-inch configuration. Ultimately, it's those growers that historically had to retrofit this technology onto their planter. Now they're calling one dealer, one location for service, for support, and also the initial sale. And will help them deliver that uniform emergence that they've come to know and expect from the early riser planter offering.
Kelly Kravig, platform manager with Case IH, says premium technology doesn't stop at planting. He talks about what farmers can look forward to with the new Axial Flow 160 series.
The advantage that the 160 series brings is we now include Harvest Command in the base machine. And what that does is it allows an individual who is a less than experienced operator to be able to operate the machine efficiently. So we can dramatically improve productivity and efficiency of the combine with a less experienced operator. So we now offer Harvest Command on our Class 6 and Class 7 machines. So our entire portfolio of combines from 160 series all the way through to our largest 250 series offers this technology.
He talks about the additional features included with the new Axial Flow 160 series.
All of these machines come with our cross-flow cleaning system, which significantly increases our overall efficiency of the cleaning system, especially in hillside operations. So with cross-flow, regardless of whether you're on a flat ground or you are on a hillside, you can maintain your productivity. All of these machines are stage 5 emissions compliant. So from our perspective on combines, they have the latest emissions and efficiency in our product portfolio. So a lot of pluses.
For more information, visit caseih.com or talk to your local Case IH dealer. Chad Smith reporting.
And now, to introduce the subject of today's story, a classic film director known far and especially wide. Everybody knows him. What was your name again?
My name is Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, yes.
And I would like to tell you about the birds and their age-long relationship with man.
Oh, goody, goody.
I suspect you never realized that if it weren't for birds, even some of our pastimes would suffer noticeably. Duck hunting, for example, and the turkey is traditionally our guest of honor at Thanksgiving.
Ah, yes, now we're getting to the subject of the Thanksgiving turkey. Now, I realize it seems a bit early to start reporting about the cost of that turkey, but everybody else is doing it, so let's gobble up this opportunity. And actually, when it comes to what we shoppers can expect to pay for that Thanksgiving turkey.
You know, I think from a consumer standpoint, we've got some fairly good news on the turkey front.
Yeah, turkey supplies up, prices down. This from Agriculture Department livestock analyst Chale Shagham. He says, judging from the current wholesale prices that stores are paying for their turkeys, we shoppers are likely to pay a good deal less for that bird than we did last year. And of course, we are still over a month away from Thanksgiving.
But right now, I mean, we are looking at wholesale frozen hen prices at about $1.18 a pound, which compares to about $1.80 a pound a year ago. So indeed, prices are for whole birds are lower than they were a year ago.
34% lower. Part of that is because during this last quarter of the year,
We're looking at about a 5% increase in production compared to a year ago.
Now, yes, a year ago, the nation's poultry operations were being hit hard by bird flu outbreaks, but we have not had any new detections of bird flu since June. So turkey producers have been working hard to get production going again. Now, in a normal year, this would be about the time that we would see wholesale turkey prices start to go up in anticipation of holiday demand. But Chale Shagham says instead,
they came down from the end of September into early October, and we may see a little bit more of a lift, you know, as we get closer to the holiday season. But again, the industry is sort of working to balance production and demand.
So overall, wholesale prices for turkeys are well below last year, but what about retail? Again, prices should be lower than last year, but how much lower? That could depend on what grocery stores decide to do.
What retailers tend to do in terms of actually retail pricing for that period, is going to depend on their desire to encourage store traffic. They will often sell turkeys at retail for less than they paid for them at wholesale, you know, what we refer to as a loss leader, to encourage folks to come into the stores and buy cranberries and stuffing and pumpkin pie filling and the usual fixings that go with Thanksgiving.
So right now, it's hard to know exactly how much that turkey is going to cost, but it's a pretty sure bet it will be less than last year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. At the top of the show, we heard about a few different laws that were recently passed that may have impacts on the California ag industry. Today, I have with me Teresa Keene, President and CEO of AgSafe, and we talk about some of the changes to paid sick leave. This is something important as it goes into effect January of 2024. Now let's sort of transition a little bit and let's talk about some other changes to something that folks already have to deal with, which is paid sick leave.
Absolutely. So paid sick leave. So we've been in California, we have been providing paid sick leave for a number of years already. And currently it's been 3 days or 24 hours of paid sick leave for employees. That has now changed beginning of January of 2024. We are now going to be at 5 days or 40 hours. So it's increasing by 2 days, essentially. And employers need to make sure that beginning January 1, they are adjusting accruals to make sure that employees are getting those 5 days.
Okay, so essentially a full week of paid sick leave.
Correct, correct. And employees can need to accrue this, the 40 hours, by the 200th day of the, essentially the year.
So this isn't something, let's say you start a new job, you've just been hired, they run over your benefits, and you know, in your a month into work and something happens and you have yet to accrue those hours, correct?
For some employers. So some employers elect to give employees all 40 hours up front. So you can do it. You can do it one of two ways. So you can give employees those 40 hours up front. They need to have worked for you for at least 30 days before they qualify for that benefit.
Okay.
Or other employers do the accrual rate. So as long as employees get to that by the 200th day, they've got their 40 hours. Essentially, it's one hour per 30 hours worked. Isn't that confusing?
Yeah, a little bit, but that's why we have you here to sort of break it all down for everybody. So as an employee, this sounds great. You know, that means, especially as a parent, if I know that I've got a sick kiddo, sometimes those germs get passed along to me. And so rather just taking 1 or 2 days off for my, you know, for my kid, I can now take the rest of the week off if I'm feeling unwell. And now that's great. However, what does this necessarily mean for the ag employer? What sort of hiccups does this cause for an agricultural employer?
So there are a number, and I think with this having kind of some uncertainty. So if you are in the heart of production and you have employees that end up calling in sick, and you don't have the team that you have in place to you know, finish up your harvest, so there are going to be some gaps that employers are going to end up feeling impacted by. And it's one of the things that we're going to encourage our ag employers to think about. We are also very cautious about our ag employers making sure that they are not telling employees that they can't take their paid sick leave. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that they make those days available. This is an issue that the Labor Commissioner has been paying a lot of attention to. Okay. And as employers, we're not allowed to tell them, deny them their sick time. We can put together some policies, but we can't, and ask folks to give us advance notice if it's a doctor's appointment. But in the case of, you know, maybe you wake up in the morning and you're not feeling well, making sure that, you know, call your employer as soon as you can. But on the employer side, there's not a ton that you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it's going to be, in terms of mitigating your risk, you want to make sure your employees are getting those sick days. It's going to be a lot cheaper than having to go through a, get a citation, a penalty, or litigation.
And now, when does this particular rule come into play?
So this starts January 1st of 2024. So folks need to start getting that plugged into their payroll systems. Thank goodness there are some great payroll systems that take care of this for us. So making sure that those are added in. And you also talk to your employees about the benefit, making sure that you're communicating with them. That goes to building trust and employee retention. And so that's what we want to make sure that we're seeing, is that employee retention, so I can keep their skilled labor workforce.
This was just a portion of my conversation with Teresa. If you'd like to find out more information, you can always visit agsafe.org. This is the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return.
But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Farm Bureau women sharpen their communication skills. 15 farm and ranch women leaders graduated from the fall session of the Women's Communication Boot Camp hosted by the American Farm Bureau Federation. The agricultural leaders completed an intensive 4-day course that featured sessions focused on public speaking, working with the media, and messaging. Program graduates will use this training to support Farm Bureau's priority issues. This includes participating in local media opportunities, sharing information with elected officials, and joining social media campaigns spotlighting modern agriculture. Isabel Chisholm, chair of the Women's Leadership Committee, says, quote, "Agriculture needs strong advocates who are willing to step up and share their stories at local, state, and national levels." The Farm Bureau women leaders who completed this training are poised to creatively use their skills in a broad range of settings. This program has a total of 284 graduates over 19 years and is open to all women involved in Farm Bureau. For more information, contact your local county Farm Bureau. NAFB contributed to that report.
Registration's now open for college teams competing in the 2024 Farm Robotics Challenge. The collegiate competition is organized by The Vine, an initiative of UC Agriculture and Natural Resources in collaboration with FarmNG, F3 Innovate, and AI Institute for Next Gen Food Systems. The Farm Robotics Challenge is an annual event where teams of students from universities and colleges across the country tackle real-world farming challenges. The competition focuses on small farm applications and leverages the state-of-the-art Amiga robot to integrate robotics into agricultural research. This year, the challenge is expanding by introducing a new division for 2-year colleges to allow more students to participate. Important dates for the competition include October 31st as the team formation deadline, and project proposals will need to be submitted by November 15th. More information is available at farmroboticschallenge.ai. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
The battle continues over WOTUS, the legal fight over EPA's wetlands jurisdiction and which ones are waters of the U.S. is likely to live up to its reputation. That's from the testimony at a Senate hearing. Former EPA Assistant Administrator for Enforcement Susan Bodine says the agency did not end the significant nexus wetlands test from its original January rule.
But in the preamble in January 23, again, that you can say something is relatively permanent just if you see a bed and bank, just if you see like wet leaves. That's the same test that had been used in the past to identify a stream, even a stream or a channel that only has water when it rains.
A vagueness the American Farm Bureau complained last month would upend the point of 2 Supreme Court cases and decades of litigation by half the states and farm groups to end EPA's wetlands uncertainty. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Bat Benefits and Global Bat Week Awareness. This week is Bat Week, celebrated October 24th through the 31st, and Kim Winter of the U.S. Forest Service discusses some of the benefits that bats provide to agriculture and goes over some of the international collaborations involved in the Bat Week Awareness Campaign.
Around the globe, bats are really well known for being both pollinators, but also nectar feeding and seed dispersing. And so they serve a really important ecological niche in doing those ecosystem services, as we call them. But here in the United States, they really just eat a lot of pests, so flying insects and moths. The International Coalition for Bat Week is really just growing sort of organically from what started throughout the Americas. And so now we're seeing bat events and festivals in as far away as Nigeria and throughout Asia, where people who generally understand the role of bats in their ecosystem, they see them a lot more visibly than we do here in the Americas, would understand bats, but maybe not want them around. And we're increasing that visibility through a series of partners that are also linked to our domestic partner here, Bat Conservation International. But through spreading the word, we're getting everyone engaged in learning more about bats, kind of understanding what they do for agriculture, what they do for rainforests.
And with more on this topic, Winter went on to talk about the history of the Bat Week awareness campaign, as well as its growth as an educational event around the globe.
We started Bat Week with a small group of bat enthusiasts at the Forest Service and with one of our partners at Bat Conservation International back in 2014. In 2017, we got the Secretary of Agriculture to proclaim it as a national week in celebrating bats. And what we've done over the years is develop an international coalition of partners, nonprofit partners, academics, museums, and federal partners across the Americas, so including Canada, the United States, Mexico. And through our Mexican partners, we've actually reached all the way into Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean. And so at this point, we have quite a number of people in our coalition celebrating Bat Week and spreading a positive narrative for bats across the Americas.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.